Hello everyone and welcome to episode 597 of So You Want to Be a Writer, the podcast that's all about writing and publishing. My name's Valerie Koo. I'm CEO of the Australian Writers' Centre, the world's leading centre for writing courses, and I'm your host. What have you been up to this week? I've been doing a lot of catch-up thanks to, you know, the couple of short weeks that we had recently because of the Easter break. And just when I thought I was getting on top of things, my to-do pile grew again and grew and grew. It's like the never-ending gobstopper, right? So anyway, let's crack straight on to chatting with Nat Newman. How are you, Nat?
I'm great, Valerie. How are you?
Good, good, good. I know that you're going to be sharing your writing tip with us this week, but first, what have you been up to? I'm always fascinated by your life and the 1 million things you do. But anyway, what have you been up to lately?
Well, you know me, always keeping busy. It's the only way I can stay out of trouble, Valerie, is to, you know, otherwise I'd just get up to mischief if I didn't have 10,000 things to do.
What kind of mischief would you get up to, Nat? I find that hard to believe.
Oh, you don't know. I could be roaming the streets starting fights with people. You know, I live in Newcastle West. It's pretty rough around here.
All right. So what have you been doing since you haven't been roaming around on the streets starting
fights?
Well,
I haven't been roaming around the streets. Actually, this weekend, I was so very, very fortunate to have my play that I wrote, The Library, premiered at the Lake Macquarie One Act Play Festival.
So oh, my God. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was amazing. I'm so proud of the actors and the director. They just put on an amazing show. So it was incredible.
How long does one act go?
That's a great question. You can actually have one act plays that go for about an hour. So it's essentially just anything without an interval, or maybe even 90 minutes you could have. But this particular festival, every play had to be under 20 minutes.
Oh, okay. And are there multiple scenes in one act, or do you just have one scene?
You can, but, you know, it's a little bit like writing a short story versus writing a novel. If you've only got 20 minutes, you don't want to waste time changing scenes. I mean, yeah, you could, but you'd be better off trying to keep your people in one location. Just for time, really.
Yeah. I love the theatre. I just love the theatre. No other reason, no other comment, just I love the theatre.
Yeah. It is exciting though, because you're seeing people really do things in real time. There's this thing in acting, it's called it's living truthfully in imaginary circumstances. And that's what you're watching when you're watching theatre. You're watching people who when it's good, they are living truthfully in those imaginary or imagined circumstances. And I think that's what makes it so compelling.
Yeah, it's just and there's just something about the feedback from the audience as well, because when you know that something has landed right and there's this collective, because when you watch TV, you're not watching it with lots and lots of people, but there's this collective energy that you can feel when there's particular emotions or when there's shock or when there's joy or whatever it is. So yeah, it's a really special experience. But anyway, let's move on to what is your writing tip this week?
What is my writing tip this week? That's a great question. Oh, I know. I had a student recently ask how long a paragraph should be. And actually they said that they'd been taught that a paragraph should be between 3 and 5 sentences. Like, that was quite strict. And I feel like that's probably like valid, maybe for report writing or essay writing. I think that can be a useful guideline to keep a paragraph between 3 and 5 sentences.
Also depends how long the sentences are.
Well, you know, this is so true. Whereas with fiction, I tend not to think of paragraphs in terms of sentences, but rather in terms of lines, because that's how they're laid out on a page. But also there's just no hard and fast rules with fiction. Like, so you might have a line of dialogue and it's 3 words. 3 words and she said. That's a whole paragraph. And then you might have 6 lines as that person then thinks about something. And those 6 lines could be 6 sentences. They could be 12 sentences. They could be 2 sentences. It depends on if you're going for a really short pace, like a staccato pace, then you'd have short sentences. Or you might be going for a more breathy pace, then you'd have longer sentences with some commas. And then you might have a paragraph that lasts for a whole page, you know, if you're going into some really intense description and often that will come after some shorter paragraphs where you then want your reader to really submerge themselves in the scene for you know, a big chunk of time. So I guess the tip is there is no hard and fast rule for paragraph length in fiction. It all comes down to what the function of that paragraph is, as to how long it's going to be.
And another tip would be not to overthink it. Like if you're writing, don't let yourself go, oh, I wonder if I should be writing a new paragraph right now. And don't let yourself wrestle with that. Just write. And you can put in paragraphs later all the time. Just don't let it stop your flow. Just write it however and figure out the paragraphs later. I do think, though, sometimes that some paragraphs are too long and people just, they see this gray wall of text. And sometimes that doesn't happen when the writing is it's so seamless that you're completely lost in it. However, I do think it is our job as writers or as editors, ultimately, if you're inserting the paragraphs, to make it a seamless journey for your reader. And if it's going to be easier for them to take a pause, or take a breath, then maybe that is where a paragraph should go. But yeah, a great, question from that student. But importantly, don't let it stop you from your creative flow.
Yeah, 100%. And that flow is really important because that's what it should do. Your flow is important as a writer, and then the reader's flow is important as well, which is what you're saying about having those breaks that allow the reader to digest what they just read before they move on to the next paragraph.
Good tip. Thanks, Nat. Talk to you
Cool,
next
thank you.
week.
All right, see you then.
That's my cue to move on to the competition that I have for you this week. I have three copies of The Last Murder at the End of the World by Stuart Turton to give away. So, Stuart Turton is the author of The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, and this story, The Last Murder at the End of the World, transports you into an enthralling mystery set amidst a post-apocalyptic society. On an island, the quest for survival rests on unraveling a murder to avoid the same deadly outcome that destroyed the rest of civilization. Here's the blurb. Solve the murder to save what's left of the world. Outside the island, there is nothing. The world destroyed by a fog that swept the planet, killing anyone it touched. On the island, it's idyllic, 122 villagers and three scientists living in peaceful harmony. The villagers are content to fish, farm, and feast, to obey their nightly curfew, to do what they're told by the scientists, until, to the horror of the islanders, one of their beloved scientists is found brutally stabbed to death, and they learn the murder has triggered a lowering of the security system around the island, the only thing that was keeping the fog at bay. If the murder isn't solved within 107 hours, the fog will smother the island and everyone on it. But the security system has also wiped everyone's memories of exactly what happened the night before, which means that someone on the island is a murderer and they don't even know it. All right, so I have three copies to give away of The Last Murder at the End of the World by Stuart Turton. Entries close on the 15th of April. All you need to do is go to writercentre.com.au/win and follow the instructions. It is super easy for you to enter. That's writercentre.com.au/win. And now, are you ready for the word of the week? The word of the week this week is invey. That's INVEIGH, invey. It sounds maybe a bit like cheering or something, but actually it means to attack vehemently in words. So you could say Stephen King inveighed against the use of adverbs, saying that the road to hell is paved with adverbs. There you go. Inveigh. Try using that in a sentence this week. And that was the word of the week. This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre, a world leader in writing courses. Our hugely popular course, How to Write About Murder, is all about creating more authentic action for your crime or thriller novel. Presented by award-winning crime author Candace Fox, this course covers 9 modules of fascinating detail, taking you beyond the police tape to explore what motivates killers and how they go about their business. You'll also immerse yourself in the chase, from the murder scene and autopsy to the investigation that follows. Here's what Danuka McKenzie says.
I am now a published author. My crime novel, The Torrent, is being published by HarperCollins. I discovered the Anatomy of a Crime, How to Write a Murder course, and I really thought that would be something that would be useful for me. I just loved it because it really broke down the different aspects of crime. So really right from the motivation to commit a crime through to the afterwards, you know, the arrest and then the prison life as well. And it really went through all the research that you need to do as a crime writer to kind of get those realistic aspects into your writing so that your readers will go with you on the story. I'm very grateful to the Australian Writers Centre and to the whole community for being able to get me to this stage of having a published novel and continuing to be able to write as my full-time job now.
You can find out more at writerscentre.com.au/murdercourse. That's writerscentre.com.au/murdercourse. Now let's move on to our writer in residence this week. And make sure you stay tuned after the interview for more fun facts on the world of writing. Today I'm talking to Kel Woods, who is an Australian historical fantasy author. Kel studied English literature, creative writing and librarianship so she could always be surrounded by stories. She's worked in libraries for 12 years, all the while doing her own fiction writing. She has such a disciplined approach to writing, which you'll hear about, and obviously her efforts have paid off, resulting in her novel, After the Forest. Thanks so much for joining us today, Kel.
Oh, thanks for having me, Valerie.
I'm very excited to be talking to you about your novel, After the Forest. I mean, there's so many things I want to ask you, especially on how you developed this incredibly beautiful and lyrical voice. But let's first talk about what is this book about?
Sure. So After the Forest is a fairy tale retelling. It's historical fantasy. And it's a sort of a sequel to the Hansel and Gretel fairy tale. It's set 15 years after the events that we all remember from the forest when the children were lost with the witch. So, it takes place in the Black Forest. It's set in a real place in a real time in the year 1650. And it tells the story of Greta, who is Gretel, who's grown up and is older now, and her brother Hans, and the fact that, strange things have come to the forest again and life might not be as peaceful as we think it might be after the end of the happy ever after of the fairy tale. And so when some, scary beasts and mysterious dark magic returns to the forest in the village, Greta finds that maybe things aren't as happily ever after all.
And what made you think, I want to do a retelling of Hansel and Gretel? Well, not really a retelling, but a sequel, really, of a reimagining of what might happen post-story.
I really love fairy tale retellings, particularly ones like Daughter of the Forest by Juliet Marillia and Bitter Greens by Kate Forsyth. I read that book and I was like, oh, my God, I want to write something like that. I just loved how they took the fairy tale that we know and those sort of bare bones and fleshed it out and made it into a story that had a real character, real feelings. I felt every stitch that Juliet's character made when she was weaving those nettle shirts to save her brothers. It's such a beautiful book. And so when I finally decided, no, I want to write, I'm going to do this. I'm going to write a novel. I'm going to give it a red hot go. That's what I decided I would focus on. And I chose Hansel and Gretel mostly because I hadn't come across anyone else writing a novel for adults about them. They were sort of quite untouched as far as I could see. And when I started thinking about, what if I made them grown up and let's look at the trauma that they would have endured and how they would, what kind of adults would they be? Like what kind of people would they be if they were real kids and if that really happened to them? So I approached it from that direction and, look into German history, fascinating history. The 17th century in Germany was full of so much. The 30 Years' War, some of the worst witch trials, like mass witch trials in history, were happening in that century. So it just seemed like the perfect setting to pop a fairy tale in and sort of flesh it out and make it a little bit gritty and a little bit real.
When did you think you wanted to be a writer? Like, when did you kind of decide, yeah, I'm going to give this a
Oh, look, I wanted to be a writer when I was seven. You know,
go?
I was always reading and always wanting to write, and that's what I studied at uni. Straight from school, I did English Lit and creative writing, and always wanted to be published and write. And in my 20s, as so often happens with all of us, not just women, you get tied down with study and having babies and doing grown-up things, and it got pushed aside for a few years there in my 20s. So I think it was around my 30th birthday that I thought, no, hang on, I wanted to be a writer. What am I doing? So that's when I sort of really, you know, and then I read, you know, started re going back to those books that I loved and read Bitter Greens and went, yeah, that's what I wanted to do. I want to do this kind of writing, and sort of plunged in from there.
What appeals? So, Bitter Greens by Kate Forsyth is a reimagining of the Rapunzel story, right? And what about that kind of story is appealing to you that made you want to write something in that, genre?
I just think I liked the way that they put it into a historical context. It was that joining of fantasy and history, which I just find so appealing because I love historical fiction and I love fantasy too. And I love how when you push the two together, you get all the magic and all of the high stakes and the darkness and the beauty, but you also have a familiar landscape and a familiar time, which I find easier sometimes to sink into. Sometimes fantasy books can be so heavy to get your head around the names and the world and the detail. There was just something like this. I just think there's something really beautiful about the blending of those two genres together. So yeah, I just really wanted to have a go of doing something with that.
I love the how proactive you were about it because you kind of go, okay, I really like Bitter Greens and I like Kate Forsyth. Oh, I'm going to do a course with Kate Forsyth and I'm going to get her to mentor me and I'm going to do multiple courses with Kate Forsyth and then look what happens.
Know. Kate and I are friends now, and so I can say this, and she knows how funny it is. But honestly, I stalked her. I was like, right, this is the person who's going to teach me how to write like this. This is the, if I'm going to go to any classes, because I love learning and I love classes, and I was always keen to learn and do the work and go to classes. She was the one. I thought, yep, she's my teacher. When I realized that she teaches, I was so excited. So that's, yeah, I did stalk her a little and rocked up at her classes and tried not to be a weirdo. Don't know how I went with that, but yeah, we've got funny stories. But yeah, but that's, I did. I was very driven, I suppose. I knew what I wanted to do, and I knew that I wanted to learn. So I found the best teacher, and you just happened to have her teaching at the Australian Writers' Centre. Thank you.
So you did several courses at the Australian Writers' Centre with multiple ones that you took with Kate. What did the courses teach you that enabled you to end up writing this story and being published?
Well, they were great courses. The first one I think I did was Creative Writing Stage 2, but that has a different name now, I think, Valerie. Is that
Yes, Novel Writing Essentials, yeah.
Novel Writing Essentials? And I sort of took that one on because I thought this will be a good one to brush up on the stuff I learned at uni and also maybe the stuff I didn't learn at uni. There was a bit of practical stuff about structure and that kind of thing, but a lot of theory and a lot of, you know, at uni. So I thought, I want to do a course that's going to give me the tools to really give this a go. Like, I always wanted to improve my technique and I wanted to learn. So I started with that. And then the plotting and planning one with Kate was probably the most important course I've ever done because that kind of gives you the tools to look at the structure of the book and how it all fits together, how it's all working. And History, Mystery, and Magic, I did as well. That was powerful too, because that's all about taking historical fiction or fantasy or mystery and how you can use elements from those different genres to make something new, which is kind of what I did in After the Forest. When you look at it, it's got elements from all of those genres in there. There's a little bit of scary stuff and a bit of a mystery as well. So they were invaluable. Yeah, they were fantastic courses.
What do you think you have to do that's a little bit different or that you have to be aware of when you're writing something in this genre as opposed to writing, you know, a regular story?
I don't know. I don't know if there's that much of a difference. I think it's just, I think the characters are still the same as characters that you would read in any genre or any or literary or any kind of writing. There's still that focus on character and story. I guess there are certain details and elements that historical fiction has. Obviously, readers of historical fiction love their history and they like to be immersed in that world and to learn about the history of that time. So I was very careful with research. I researched it as if it was just a historical novel. I tried anything that was about the Black Forest and German food and culture and the way they were dressing and all of that stuff. I researched as thoroughly as I possibly could to make that world feel real. But then on the other side of it, I had all the magic and the witchcraft and the fantasy elements too. So that's obviously really important to fantasy readers who love magic systems and world building and all of that beautiful stuff that you find in fantasy. So, yeah, I tried to approach it in both ways.
So let's talk about the historical research. And oddly, just on the weekend, I met a couple and had a bit of a chat with them, and they're from the Black Forest. Oh, and I said, well, you should read this book. Anyway, so so tell me, where does one even start? You know, yeah. Where did you start? Because it's so broad, right? Where did you start, or did you kind of just plunge straight in and kind of, you know, see where it took you? How did you know how to approach the research and what you needed to know?
I'm trying to think how I started. Usually I'd start with just Wikipedia and Google and look at the period and the time, and then it goes deeper from there. I'm a librarian as well, so that I was a reference librarian for years.
You'd know where to look.
Yeah, I know my way around research, which probably helped a bit, really. I did a lot of Googling in German. A lot of what I needed wasn't in English.
Yeah. So how did you navigate that? Did you then have to put it in Google Translate or something?
Yeah. Wow. So a lot of Google translating, Googling in German. Found a couple of really great books in English that on the 30 Years' War as well, to get that sort of, there's a few bits in the book that are kind of grim, and those details, I was looking for those, you know, those telling details. And you hear writers talking about finding those telling details. I've heard Kate talk about it in her classes, and it's just finding that one little historical detail that says so much about the time and is so evocative. So I was always searching for those little details. And
What's an example of that?
An example of that in After the Forest would be I read an amazing book on the history of bears in Europe.
Wow.
Yeah. Weird stuff. Like, it was all a bit weird. History is so weird in that period. The early modern period is so weird. But a lot of that stuff made it into the book, and I didn't even make it up, Valerie. I just used the history, which is pretty way out. And at that time, bears were perceived as being the devil's animals, like the devil's beast. They were the color, the black and the brown and the red they were believed to be the devil's colors, which is why Greta, who has red hair, you know, that's part of that whole red hair and devilish sort of culture, that superstition. And so when there's a scene where the bear is being discussed by the pastor in the village, and he's saying that the bear is the devil's guise, and he will lure you into the cave, and all these awful things that bears do. People really believe that about bears. Bears were really reviled and feared because they were quite human in the way they moved. They could stand on their back legs, and they could open a door, and they could do all these human movements.
And they could take you out.
They could also take you out. Absolutely, they could. And there used to be a lot more bears. There weren't any bears in the Black Forest at that time. They'd all been hunted away, which is in the book as well. They'd all been hunted, and they were probably in the Alps and sort of really remote regions, because they were just hated and feared. They, in medieval times, they were quite honored, and then they fell from grace. And so that's what I mean. Like, that was such an amazing detail. I thought, oh, I can definitely use that in the book. And I didn't have to make it up, but it was pretty wild.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of all of the, so you do all this research, and obviously I presumably you did it when you kind of knew you were going to do the Hansel and Gretel thing, right? So at what point did you know, okay, I got to stop, or I could research forever, because you could, I'm sure, especially with the resources that you know exist as a librarian.
Yeah, you could. I guess I wanted to get a feel for it all first, and then once I had, I also plan like I planned the book, and I had that shell of the fairy tale, so I knew that there were certain elements and motifs that would go into that plan. So I think once I had had some research done, had that shell of the structure and a shape, an idea of the shape of the story, then I stopped the research. But that being said, I was still researching things all the way up until it was in the copy edit stage, because there were little facts to check and little details to put in. So it's a constant, it was a constant process too. I've just finished my second book and the same thing. I'm still researching things as I go too.
So on that then, you do your research, but it's this really interesting combination of actual research of real historical facts and events and this element of fantasy, where there's this extra layer of the world that you need to create. So on a practical level, did you just kind of immerse yourself and absorb all the things and then start writing, or did you build a world in some kind of practical way, by writing things down in a dossier or whatever? How did you go about that?
Yeah, I use Evernote. So I'm a big Evernote user, and I use spreadsheets as well. I'm very organized and nerdy.
You sound very organized.
Yeah, I love Evernote because you can have all my research was all categorized into little notebooks for food, and then there was a notebook for clothing, and then there was a notebook for the 30 Years' War and bears and wolves and shape-shifting and superstition. So I had it all nailed down pretty easily. And I loved Evernote because you can tag. So I could tag things with telling details, or I could tag food, or I could tag all heaps of tags. And then I can go back and find what I need really easily. So yeah, Evernote is just amazing. I love
So
it.
talk to me about that. I'm really interested because, I mean, I use Evernote. I think it's great as well. What do you do? Let's say you are researching food, okay, and you've come across some German texts, some English texts, whatever. What do you actually do? Do you put links in there? Do you copy and paste? How do you actually extract and store the information that you need?
I tend to make a master note for each notebook, where if I find a paragraph that's interesting, for example, I'll just put that in there. It doesn't really need its own massive note. It just needs a section. So there'll be one that's like I call it my master note, and that's where most of the information goes. And then sometimes I will clip an entire article and just pop that in there as well. Have you got the little wiki, like the little, what's it called? It's up in the top right, those little widgets or the little shortcut. What's that called?
Yes, what is that called? On top of your browser, the clip.
Oh
It's a clipper. It's an Evernote clipper, right?
it's a little
The
clipper.
Chrome extension on Evernote clipper. Yeah.
Extension, that's the word. So the Evernote extension allows you to clip a selection or the entire article. So sometimes I'll just take the whole article and put it in as well. And I like their little checkbox feature, how you can create a little checkbox. So in the latest book I've done, because I'm learning as I go too, I'm a bit better at using Evernote with the second time around because the first time I was learning. But this one, for example, I found a whole bunch of dishes and foods that I can use in this book. And I did a little checkbox next to them. So every time I've used it, I tick it off. So every time, oh, I need a meal, I need a dessert. And I can go into Evernote, oh, there's one, and use that and then use the checkbox feature. So it's just handy for wrangling the details.
That is great. And I also the thing is, we have all these apps at our disposal. And like as I said, I use Evernote. But sometimes we only scratch the surface. And when we go one layer deep, it can actually be so much more helpful to us. And you've bothered to do that, which is great. But talk to me about you said a spreadsheet. What was the spreadsheet for?
I use a spreadsheet for my like word counts and time I spend writing. I log when I'm on a deadline. I put in because I have to be accountable, Valerie. Otherwise, I'll just you know, stuff around. So if I have to get something done, I have like, okay, I did 7 hours today. Oh, I can relax. Well done. But if I haven't, I have to log. I put a little timer on. If I'm having trouble writing, I'll do a 45-minute sprint and try and get myself back in the groove. I've only got to do 45 minutes. You can do this, Kel. Just do 45 minutes.
You are so disciplined. Okay, now I sort of waylaid you a little bit. Let's come back to you were talking about Evernote, but what we were talking about beforehand was with the magical, so that with the fantasy side of things, how did you or did you map out any part of that world before you started writing, or did you just go into it and kind of magic just happens, you know, when you decided to?
I think the way I work is that magic comes last, actually. Like I think the book was well on the way and the story was in place and I had all my characters, and then the witch stuff and the magic stuff, I had to stop and think about that and then weave that through. I think I'm more of a I probably start more like an a historical writer and then do the magic later. So there were still elements of the magic and Greta's interactions with the magic, because there's a pull between the darkness and the light. That probably I was still working on right up until the last sort of edits. So that came more gradually. I think that's hard. I find that hard. It's hard because you're like, oh, I've got to get the, you know, get the historical stuff right. And now I've got to go and create a magic system that works. It's like, well, I know you know Alison Tate, but I know her too. I live close to Al, and she did an event with me when the book came out at the library. And she said to me, "Why do you do this? Why don't you just make it all up like I do? Like, are you insane, basically? Because you're like torturing yourself trying to like do it in the real world." I said, "I know, I'm an idiot."
I actually love that though. I actually think that gives it that extra layer of robustness. Or I love when I learn things. I love when I learn things from fiction. Usually it's because of a historical you know setting. And I absolutely think that that's awesome because it's almost an extra layer of satisfaction when you've you know finished reading the book. Talk to me about the time frame. So give me a bit of an idea of, you know, when you got the idea, how much time you spent on the research before you started writing, how long that took, and what kind of, I'm going to say regime for you because you're so disciplined. What kind of regime you've imposed on yourself to get the words done?
It took me longer than I wanted it to, because I was, as I said, I've had kids and I was studying and I was working as a librarian full time for quite a few years as well. And I think probably after I got the mentorship with Kate, which was the end of 2014, and then we started working together in 2015, that's where I started to really get disciplined and put that time in. Because up until then, it had been like, I haven't always been like this regimented. Like, I've learned how to do this, sort of had to learn. But yeah, you know, so yeah, it took me a couple of years to really find that rhythm and get that going. And then, so from about 2015 through to 2020 is when I got an agent. So there's a period of years there, and the research would have happened before I started working, and then it would have continued all the way through. I love research. I could research
I
forever.
know that's the you know scary part because you could get stuck on that. But talk to me then about you obviously started writing while you were busy, you were working full time. What kind of time were you giving yourself to write in that period where you were doing many other things?
Yeah, so that's where the spreadsheet came in, because because I had like when I had time that was available. I actually did a class with Alison, and it was about making time to write.
Oh yes, that
Yeah,
was yeah, that was at the Australian Writers' Centre as well.
it was. Yeah, I think I did like a test run with her when she was developing
Great.
that class. And that was, you know, she's been great for me in that, because I remember working in the library and her coming in and borrowing books and saying, oh, I just wish I could write and I just don't have any time, like just a drama. And she said, you have to make time. No one is going to give you time. If you want to do this, you have to make time. And that really stuck to me. In fact, that's probably one of the things I learned from Kate Forsyth as well, who is such an efficient and productive woman. Like, she is the busiest person I know, I think. She's incredible. Yep, and just learning that, you know what, no one is going to give you time. If you want to write a book, you have to put your bum in the seat and write it. And no one is going to say, oh, here's an extra 3 hours that you can magically have. So that's where the spreadsheet and the organization came, having a look at my schedule and looking at what I have to go to work. So between that 9 and 5, I can't write, but I have lunch breaks and I have evenings. And I remember going through a stage of getting up at 5 a.m. and working before work as well, and working in my lunch breaks. And
so were you aiming for a certain number of hours per week while you were having that full-time job? Yeah. So what was that?
It was, do you remember? 12 hours minimum.
Okay, great. And
20 hours was good on top.
Okay. So you worked during your lunch breaks? You took yourself off and into a quiet space and wrote? Good on you.
Oh, thanks. I always have a notebook too, like a paper and like a an old school notebook. So sometimes it would best be roughing out dialogue or an idea for a scene in a notebook. But yeah, I found that I had to find the time myself, and sometimes it was in weird little spaces, and I just had to take advantage of that when I came to it. And so that's where the idea for kind of logging in, I did 45 minutes in my lunch break. That counts. You did well. Like, that kind of reward. Like,
that's great. You know? That's great. Did you, if you reached a target, did you give yourself a reward in any way? Because rewards really work for me. I'm curious to know whether they worked for you. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, maybe I could watch some Netflix or I just felt good about myself. I just felt like it was more that I felt like I'd achieved something.
Mm.
Maybe I'm weird. I sound really weird, don't I?
No, you don't. That sounds great. It's very inspirational. So at some point you got yourself an agent. Now, at what point was your manuscript when you got yourself an agent? You know, because obviously you can't just get yourself an agent on an idea. You need something to show them. So what did you have?
I had the full book.
Right.
And I'd done 2 or 3 edits with Kate on it as part of the mentorship. She gave me extra time. She really liked the book and believed that it could go somewhere. So she was incredibly, I'll be grateful to her forever for the help that she gave me. She's amazing. So it was full. It was done. It was a complete manuscript that had a couple of structural edits with Kate. And then when I started pitching it, it was in that shape. But my agent used to be a publisher, and so she edits as well. She's very hands-on. So when we met, she said, do you mind if we do another edit on it? And I said, not a problem. I love editing. I'm ready to do the work. And then we got it into a shape that she was happy with and I was happy with, and that's when we started submitting it to publish.
And what happened then?
And then I got a publishing deal with Tor in the US. It was so
amazing. Do you recall when you were told? How were you told?
There were meetings. We were having these weird meetings at 10:30 p.m. because Julie's in England and we were meeting with people in New York. So there were these strange meetings, and then I had to think about, there was more than one offer from a couple of the publishers in the US. So there was I had to think about what I wanted. And I'd always, if you'd asked me my dream publisher, I would have said Tor, because they published Juliet Marillia and Sarah Douglas and Cecilia Dart Thornton, like these beautiful female fantasy writers who I just loved when I was much younger. I still love them. But yeah, so I just couldn't believe it. It was just like, whoa, what has happened here?
How exciting. Were you told at 10:30 at night and you were struggling to stay awake? Do you recall the moment you found out?
It would have been via email, and it would have been when I first woke up in the morning, because everything was happening while I was asleep.
Yes.
But I do remember when when Julie emailed me and said that, or when Tor emailed me and said that HarperCollins in Australia had made an offer, and it was early, and I read it and I burst into tears, and I walked out because I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. And I walked out into the kitchen and my husband said, what's wrong? Has someone died? Like, he thought that something horrific had happened. I said, no, HarperCollins is going to publish the book in Australia. It was amazing. I remember being really, really shocked and emotional and just like crying like an idiot.
But also it was what a reward after being so persistent for, you know, working at this story for quite some time. What kept you going? Because I know a lot of people who are very talented, but they would not have kept going. What kept you going? What's your advice to people to keep going?
Oh, look, there were times when I would stop for 6 months because it was too hard. It was just so hard to be working all the time and giving up my social life. I didn't have a social life for years. I still don't really have much of one, but that's okay. I don't mind that. I don't know. I don't know. I just think I must be a really stubborn person. I just kept going. I just kept rallying and kept going because it just felt wrong not to. Like, a life without writing in it was just not something I was willing to do. It just felt empty. So I think that, you know, if you can live without it and if you're happy, you know, then that's great. I wasn't. I always felt like there was something I had to do. There was something niggling at me.
Wow. And
I just kept going. I'm so glad.
Yeah, fantastic. The way you write, well, this story is a deeply immersive experience. And from the moment you start reading, I was actually initially picturing myself in that world, but I was reading the book, which is so weird. And then I got it kind of into a whole other layer. What techniques did you use to get your reader to be able to do that? What did you do to make it that deeply immersive?
I don't know. It's amazing how many people say to me, I felt like it's a movie. I could see it in my head. And I see all books like that. Like, I kind of see everything like a movie. So it took me a while to realize that maybe not everybody sees a book like a movie when they read them, not all books are written like that. So it's something I've been thinking about. I don't really know. I don't know if it's a sensory thing. I don't know if it comes down to those telling details. I did go to the Black Forest. And I walked in the forest and I saw bears and wolves in a sanctuary, and I got to look at how the light is and what the air feels like and what things sound like, and maybe that helped to make it feel immersive. But I didn't really set out. It wasn't something I thought about. It just
came naturally to you. So tell me now about the Grandmaster Plan. You've written this fantastic book. You've already written the next one. What's the Grandmaster Plan for your author career?
Oh, I'd love it to get more contracts and keep working, you know, keep this going. The second book is coming out in about a year. So
is it a reimagining?
Yeah, it's another reimagining. It's different fairy tales, a different time, different country. It's I can tell you it's got mermaids in it. So it's a Little Mermaid.
How fantastic.
Yeah. thank you.
So how do you combine, because now it's a little bit different, right? You had to write the second book in a much shorter time than you wrote the first book. And that happens a lot to authors, because they can toil for 10 years or whatever on their first book, and then suddenly they have a 2-book contract, or they, you know, the publisher says, we want the second one. So with that, then, how have you combined that with your life and your other commitments?
Yeah, that was a massive adjustment. It's funny, because I knew I wanted to write the book, and I really, really wanted to write a book. And then I realized that people were actually going to read it. And that was just terrifying. That's like so scary. So even just going through the process of thinking people I know are going to read this, like how terrifying is that? But I've moved through that. It's okay. It's now not just a little selfish hobby. Now it's sort of like something that's what I can do, and I can get paid for it, and it's a real thing. So it's I only work part-time now in my paid job, so I've dropped down to just part-time because I was working full-time and doing all the edits and working on it, and it was a lot. So I work part-time. And
so how many days a week do you work now?
I work 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and then the rest is writing?
And the rest is writing, yeah. So 3 days writing, 2 days paid work. I work in comms and marketing, which is kind of new for me. It's like in a museum. So it's still in library museum world, but slightly different. I write for those 3 days, usually on the weekends too. I still kind of work 5 days on the writing. And, you know, all the bits that come with that, like the social media, and there's always bits and pieces to do, like, and the admin stuff and the business of writing, which, and you know, you don't really know until it happens to you. There's no, I was a long time listener of the So You Want to Be a Writer podcast, and it's really different listening to other people talking about it and then doing it yourself. Like, nothing can really prepare you, I don't think, for the roller coaster of it all. So now I'm thinking about my next projects, and I'll be chatting with my agent about those in the coming weeks, and hoping that I can get to do this again.
So if the second book is a reimagining, retelling, mm-hmm. Is this your oeuvre now? Like, is the third one that you want to write also going to be a reimagining?
Yeah, I think I've got maybe three projects that I'm sort of just tinkering with and thinking that I could pitch. They're all retellings. Oh, yeah, they're all retellings. Or if they're not, they might be, I think one of them might be folklore, like a
particular folktale,
that kind of thing, like based on that. So I always look at the setting, the history, and the fairy tale or the folklore, and see if there's connections between those three things. So I'm in that sort of dreaming and thinking stage at the moment, trying to figure out what I want to do next. But I love horror too. I could maybe one day just do a straight historical, maybe that wouldn't scare me. Maybe just something more fantastical that doesn't have any, I don't know. I really don't know, but I love that area, like the fairy tale retelling, historical fantasy. That's probably where my heart is.
Wonderful. And you've done such an incredible job with After the Forest. So let's finish with what are your top three tips for aspiring writers who would love to be in this position one day where you are?
My top three tips. Well, firstly, I would say keep going. So just keep going, because you don't know what's around the corner. And I remember feeling that I took too long to write After the Forest, and that I was a bit of a failure because I didn't bash it out fast enough, and I had really high expectations on myself about when it should be done and how fast it should, but it takes as long as it takes. So just keep going. The timing of it worked really well for me, because when I pitched, it was the perfect time to pitch that kind of book during COVID, when romanticy and fantasy was sort of going through this beautiful renaissance that it's been going through. So it turned out that the time that it took for me to write didn't matter. It was better in the end. So don't have too much pressure on yourself about timing, and just keep going, just keep working. My second would be to learn, to go to classes, to read books about writing, to learn as much as you can about the craft of writing, get your technique down. That's where you're going to get those, you know, it's where you're going to get beautiful sentences and beautiful writing. And that's important, because you need that first page to shine when an agent or a publisher looks at it. It needs to be beautiful. So it does matter with the words you choose and the technique that you have. So definitely work on your craft. And my third one would be, try not to listen to what anybody else is doing. Just stay in your lane and focus on what's happening inside your creative brain. Like, focus on your story that you want to tell. I think it's easy to look at what other people are doing and, I should be doing that, and maybe I should be writing this genre because it's really popular right now. And, yeah, you do need to have your eye on the industry and what's trending and what's popular, but I think the strongest stuff comes from when it's something that you really love. So stay true to your little creative soul.
Wonderful. And on that note, thank you so much for your time today, Kel.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre, a world leader in writing courses. Our course, Historical Fiction, is perfect for anyone writing a novel or family history that's set in the past, giving you the tools to use research, facts, and historical events to make your story come to life. When you're writing historical fiction, authenticity is everything. Just as each accurate detail can help immerse your reader in that time and place, a wrong step can quickly take them out again. In this course, you'll gain amazing insights, guidance, and resources to help you research and craft a book that readers will love. And you'll discover how to avoid the common mistakes that many new authors of historical fiction make. The lessons will shine a flashlight on the past, helping you to effectively research previous eras so you can weave compelling characters and details into your story. It's a valuable addition to your author toolkit. And because this is one of our online self-paced courses, you'll enjoy instant access and can learn at your own pace with 12 months access to all course materials. Find out more at writerscentre.com.au/historical. That's writerscentre.com.au/historical. So we're nearly at the end of this week's episode, but I just wanted to mention that this week I was reading about irreversible binomials, as you do, of course. So in linguistics, an irreversible binomial is a pair of words that go together in a certain order. For example, salt and pepper, bride and groom, mix and match, because you rarely say match and mix, right? Wear and tear, back and forth, you never say forth and back, food and drink, and so on. In English, it would just sound weird to say them the other way around. Although, you know, maybe in other languages it would be normal to say pepper and salt or cold and hot. Who knows? Anyway, there you go. Irreversible binomials. Well, we've reached the end of this week's episode. Thanks for hanging out with me. I really appreciate it. And if you do have 30 seconds to leave a review or rating on Apple Podcasts or the podcast app of your choice, that would be awesome because it helps other people discover the podcast. Do feel free to connect with me on social media. I'm at Valerie Koo on Twitter and Instagram, mainly on Instagram, and also on Facebook, of course. And join our Facebook listener community. Just search for So You Want to Be a Writer podcast community and request to join. I'd love to see you in there. Thanks for listening, everyone, and I look forward to chatting to you again next time. Thanks for listening to So You Want to Be a Writer. You'll find the show notes at writerscentre.com.au/podcast or sign up for our awesome and often hilarious weekly newsletter at writerscentre.com.au/news, where you'll find writing resources, giveaways, competitions, and much more.